Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to another Curzon Film Podcast. This week, the pangs of the dying embers of passion in Wildlife and the passionate dying members of gangs in Widows. I'm Jake Cunningham, your host for today. And with me, we have two brand new voices to the podcast. You'll know her words for Sight and Sound and The Skinny. It's Kelly Weston.
Hello.
And we're also joined by the cinema editor for Culture Whisper, Ella Kemp.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Good.
Tired.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big week. We normally only allocate time for one film of the week, but it's one of those special weeks where we couldn't pick and we've got to do two. So we're going to smash our way through both Wildlife and Widows, as well as talking to Wildlife's director, the wonderful Paul Dano, who sat down with not yourself, Kelly, but regular Kelly Powell, who we are sending our well wishes to, who twisted out her back last night. But Wildlife, it first premiered, well, a long, long time ago in the world of cinema. Ella, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about this film before we hear from its director, Paul Dano.
I would love to. So Wildlife is the directorial debut for actor Paul Dano. It's adapted from the novel of the same name by Richard Ford. And Paul Dano adapted this. He first wrote a draft of the script himself, and then he showed it to his partner, Zoe Kazan, actor and screenwriter as well. And she rewrote the draft herself, and they passed it back and forth, and they now share screenwriting credits. So it's a labour of love between the pair of them. So the film premiered at Sundance, then it went on to feature in the first feature strand at Cannes, then Toronto Film Festival, New York Film Festival, London Film Festival, and it's finally out in cinemas this week, and I am so glad.
Yeah, it's done a pretty tremendous gap year, just a lot of travelling there. And yeah, I don't know really much about this. I have to say, I haven't seen it yet, so I'm really looking forward to catching up on it, but I know you two do like the film. Ella, it was your review for Sight and Sound that I remember first emailing you about, and saying, do you want to come and talk about this when it comes out? Because that was a particularly fantastic review. But let's hear from the director, Paul Dano.
It's very lovely to meet you.
Yeah.
Nice. Welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast.
Thanks.
And thanks for being here.
Yeah.
And congratulations on your film. I thought it was such a moving, intimate portrayal of family life and a family in crisis. So really, congratulations.
Thank you.
You co-wrote this film with your writing partner and real-life partner, Zoe Kazan. I wanted to know how the story came to you guys and what your writing process was like as writing partners.
Yeah, so I read this book called Wildlife by Richard Ford. The first sentence and paragraph remains one of my favorites ever. So I was sort of in on the book immediately, just as a reader, I mean. And
remember what it was?
Sure,
what
yeah.
Was it?
Well, I the first sentence, I won't go the whole first paragraph, but it's in the fall of 1960, when I was 16 and my father was for a time not working, my mother met a man named Warren Miller and fell in love with him.
Wow. Okay.
It's like,
it grabs you instantly.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Yes. So I was just, and even 20 something pages in, I was having a very big experience reading the book. It really reminded me of myself, my parents, my grandparents. Thematically, just sort of the American dream, and then the sort of backdrop of the sort of the home being the world on this against this landscape, mm-hmm. which feels like, you know, so huge, and the edge of the world and the sort of fires on the horizon. And so I just kind of fell in love. And gave it to Zoe to read and said, what do you think? Could it be a movie? And we talked about it, and I read it and thought about it. And sort of not everything in the book might work for a film. So when I thought of what the ending of the film might be and the final image, that's kind of when I felt really like, oh, I think I can do this. So I wrote a first draft. I gave it to Zoe. She tore it apart. And we fought. Yeah. And then she said, why don't you let me do a pass? I see what you're trying to do.
Okay.
And I said, great.
Okay.
And then we started a sort of long process of just trading it back and forth. We'd talk for a few hours, and then one of us would take it. Mm. And we'd option it ourselves. So it was on our time, meaning, you know, we weren't on a deadline. We also weren't paying our rent writing it. We were writing it for fun for us.
Personal project.
And acting, you know, is so one of us might go away and one of us might work on the script. And once it was really ready, then we went and tried to make it.
So how long did it take you in total to get like the finished script that you were happy with?
A few years, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, but again, with time on our side, meaning
not always working on it.
Yeah. There's a great thing in Stephen King's book on writing where he says write your first draft, put it in a sealed envelope for 6 to 8 weeks and don't look at it.
Yeah.
You know, and we sort of had that built in
okay.
to the process, because we might disappear for a while and go work on something, and then you come back to it and your eyes are refreshed and you go, oh, okay, yeah. And it just kind of matures over time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so you touched on the American dream, and this film for me had so much to do with identity crises, each of them going through their own kind of identity crisis as individuals and as a family unit. I mean, the setting happens at a time where America itself was going through sort of an identity reconstruction after the war. So what was it about these themes, you know, the breakdown of that family unit and these people in crisis, that drew you as a new directorial voice to the story in contemporary times?
I think that was a very good analysis.
Thank you.
Yeah. For me, I think the first entry point is actually just the personal connection. And for me, I found the mystery of who our parents are kind of haunting or intoxicating or something, you know. And so why family? And also, I think something he did very well was how family is one of the greatest loves of our life. And almost because of that, it's also sometimes like some of our greatest pain.
Yeah.
We certainly interrogated why 1960, and there's something archetypal about it. The time period, this post-war America, this idea that life is supposed to be good and you're now promised a good, safe life. And that the American dream promises you this sort of thing on the horizon and life's always better. And then one day you sort of go, but my life's right here. And, and you know, Jerry, the father, I think a good looking guy, right? Good with people, athletic. I think he, at a young age, you're promised like a great life. And I think at a certain point he realized it's not what he was
talked up to be.
And can't, you know, and he's been sort of able to displace it for years and say, no, it'll get, you know, and then one day it's, and I think the parents do go through a crisis of identity is exactly right. I think it's a coming of age film for a family, not just the kid.
The film also relies heavily on the character of Joe, you know, witnessing this sort of unfolding happening at a time where, you know, he's also coming of age, as you said, and forming his own ideas about his life and where he fits in with all of it. So I wanted to ask you about the, you know, what were you looking for when you were casting Joe, and how did you find Ed Oxenbold?
Oxenbold. Great. And I'm going to finish answering the question before, because now I remember where we were going.
Okay.
Which is that for me, family is also just timeless. And like, I really have always loved the idea that the more personal something is, the more universal it is. And I just think that that's also an avenue, family. We all have one in some way, shape, or form. And looking at marriages breaking and how many, you know, of us grow up with parents who are struggling in some capacity and sort of what it feels like to realize your parents had a past life or that they struggle or that they mess up, you know, so that being sort of the Eden of childhood. And I know it's gradual probably, but I think it feels often like one day you wake up and suddenly like, it's like, oh shit, wait, you know, what happened? Or I didn't know that. Or And so I loved the time period also because of stepping into, like, it helps me as an audience member. Mm. I just think one step removed actually sometimes lets you sort of see yourself.
Yeah.
And the aesthetic is obviously really, you know, special in that time.
Totally.
And then the film is even more modern than I think that I anticipated it slowly as we worked on it. Unfortunately, especially like the past few weeks, it feels like this Jeanette character has come to life in a slightly new way, which is really interesting how that works in art and, you know,
it's
how
funny,
history repeats itself. And it's felt so vital that 1960 be the place for her struggle. But, you know, it's sort of we're having a strange time in America right now. And, you know, anyway, so Ed, the kid, very scary to make a film with a kid who's in almost every scene, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't think I totally realized that while writing it until we were going to cast it. We had a great casting director in New York named Laura Rosenthal. We saw a lot of kids. Ed was one of the last tapes we got. Got a tape from Australia, a kid named Ed Oxenbold, which is a great name.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very, like, American film, so I just didn't, like, anticipate casting an Australian kid with a great American accent, you know. But his was by far the best audition. He was the really the only young actor we saw that could kind of fill in the space between the lines.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I mean? Like the thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Like it wasn't just that he could say the lines well or something. Like he was really thinking.
Yeah.
And you could see it. And the movie is reliant, like this, that space is kind of where it lives, actually.
Yeah, in the quiet spaces, yeah.
Yeah, and that's sort of where I think a lot of its truth and sort of... I've always liked the illusion of simplicity, so trying to just create nice compositions and let the actor's inner life sort of be the movement.
Mm-hmm.
And we couldn't have made the film without Ed, so I feel really, really lucky that we found him.
Yeah, he's really fantastic.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask what you saw the role of nature playing in the film, because for me it was this ever-present sort of uncontrollable force that was always under the surface, and at times it was like as if humanity and nature were at odds with each other. Jerry fighting the fire, and the role that nature plays in the film.
You're doing great. This is good. Yeah,
thanks.
Really. It's lovely. So you've already reflected, I think, a little bit of it, which was nicely said. So being at odds is one thing, but I also feel like sometimes our emotional life is like that a little bit. Do you know what I mean? Like it's bigger than us occasionally, and it's sometimes out of our control.
Yeah.
So a period of crisis, I don't think these parents are, they're exploding, you know, like they're not totally in control of that moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they lose control.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for a kid seeing that, there's something of nature just in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that being on the edge of the world in this town in Montana, these fires sort of out there in the distance, there's something, I don't know. I feel like it's really like in the belly as well.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah. Well, because we are animals.
Yeah,
know?
And there's a helplessness, I think. There's a helplessness for these characters.
Mm-hmm.
Or they feel helpless, maybe, at least, you know.
Okay, so what was it like to be doing this as your first sort of directorial debut, having worked with such incredible directors? I mean, There Will Be Blood, I think, is one of the best films ever made. And you must have learned something from Paul Thomas Anderson. And was it always something you wanted to do, or is it something that sort of just progressed?
For a long time, for a long time, yeah. And I think it's actually informed my acting quite a bit, just meaning I don't just care about the part, like the film and the filmmaker really turn me on.
Mm.
And so sometimes I'm actually prone to take like a, quote, smaller part, but in a film that feels like a film to me.
Yeah.
So I've always sort of been, you know, a bit snobby that way, so to speak, because I love film. So yes, along the way, I mean, the funny thing is when you're acting in something, you're like a horse with blinders on. And so it's, you know, I've always sort of gotten off on when I get like getting to work with Roger Deakins or whoever, you know, it's like really exciting. And there's some information by osmosis, but usually then when I get there, you know, so, but for sure, somebody like Paul Thomas Anderson, a lot of filmmakers, just seeing the sort of temperature on their set, seeing how the crew is sort of enmeshed in it and that they want to be there, the spirit of it, the attention to detail, the focus, the sort of tenacity, and the love, you know, and the care, that sort of everything matters, you know, and making a film is kind of a constant fight. You know, you're pushing a rock up a hill, takes an incredible amount of will.
Thank you so much for chatting.
Yeah. Great.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So, Kelly, this is a first film from an actor turned director. Whenever someone announces that they're going to do that, there's a intrepidation, but anticipation. You're always interested.
Yeah, and I really love Paul Dano as an actor. It's unfortunate that he's not had the career that I wished for him, but he's always great whenever he turns up in films. So just a really great character actor, and apparently now a really great director and screenwriter. It's a really, really assured, really meticulous debut. I think a lot of first-time actors have a tendency to be quite indulgent with their work, and this is a really, like, tight, clean, just very focused film. And he managed to get some really, really good performances out of his actors. I mean, Jake Gyllenhaal and Carey Mulligan, we know, are, like, incredible. But the actor who plays their son, whom I cannot remember his name.
Is that Ed Oxenbould?
It is, yes. He's incredible. I think he gives a really wonderful performance in this. So, kudos to Paul Dano and to Zoe Kazan, is also a favorite of mine.
And so you mentioned there about actors maybe being a bit indulgent with their films. Maybe some might get lost down a river. Who's to say when they do a directorial debut? But I'm curious about when actors, or maybe even screenwriters, I was thinking in the case of Aaron Sorkin with Molly's Game, who feel like they're magpieing from their directors. So Aaron Sorkin, like, lifting from a bit of Fincher, picking from directors. I'm wondering whether there's any of Dano's directors' works that you might see in this, or does it very much feel like his own film?
I think it really feels like a labour of love, and you can tell that it's so careful about the way the characters are crafted, and their stories just feel so specific. I think because it's a suburban family, it is very small, and it's not really trying to be more epic than it is, but because it's all just done in such a delicate way, it feels like it matters enough to not have to draw comparisons to, you know, wider stylistic tropes or anything like that. It's the Brinsons, the family in this film, feel like a family that you've seen in other films, but then also I found watching it, it feels like my family or someone else.
The BBC sitcom.
Yes, that exact one. No relation to my personal life or feelings in the slightest. But it's really wonderful. And I have fond memories of watching it as much as really painful ones and sad ones, just thinking about the very quiet moments where nothing tragic really happens, but you can still feel that everyone has still kind of fallen apart a little bit.
Okay, and it manages to tread that line between kind of being reflective and meditative and not stilted.
Well, I think it could have very easily become a hammy sitcom,
right. But
I don't think it did at all. I think there's a lot of power and fire in the way that these characters are unhappy with their lives, but I don't think it ever sways too far into melodrama or something that you can tell is, this is a good trope for drama, for something that's really going to, you know, get you crying.
Okay. So let's look into those key performances. Jake Gyllenhaal, he's playing a golf pro who gets fired and then gets enlisted as a firefighter. Is that right?
Yeah, well, yeah. So he decides to... He's the one who... He doesn't get enlisted. So a lot of people in the town are enlisted because there are wildfires menacing the city. It's set in Montana. So Jerry Brinson, he gets fired because he's too friendly with the golfers. And so that really hits him hard because... You know, he's the man of the family and he's got this stress that he can't provide for his family anymore. But then when he's asked back, that's almost an insult to his identity and how good he is. So he decides himself to go and fight these fires, not because it pays well or because it's a particularly big thing to do, but it's a thing that he can do. Yeah, he's this really conflicted man who has to show that he can do things and that he's strong, but doesn't really know how to show that to his wife and to his son.
And what about Carey Mulligan? What's her role in this one?
Carey Mulligan has a really fascinating role. I don't think I've ever really seen a character like this before, because at the same time that you're watching Jake Gyllenhaal's character, who's, this is a really well-performed, but I still think quite traditional sort of unraveling of masculinity and, you know, men of that era being far too prideful in a way that can really destroy the family just because of how, you know, the conventional family structure was set up back then. But Carey Mulligan is somebody who, you know, we don't realize it at first when we're watching her, but is somebody who's really quite repressed, which is also quite indicative of the era. And she sort of slowly, you watch her essentially reverse in maturity while she has to raise her son. So you would think in this setup, she would become so much more resourceful and independent now that she's the single mother of a 14-year-old, but actually she becomes like increasingly more dependent. She very much clings to her son, but also doesn't really treat him like a child. So she forces him to grow up in a lot of ways that are really unfair, really. You don't blame her. I mean, she makes a lot of choices in the film that definitely make you, as a viewer watching her, really frustrated, but the entire time, I felt a lot of sympathy for her, for somebody who we learn, you know, later she and Jake Gyllenhaal, as, you know, Stander got married really early and had their son, and she really didn't have a chance at a full youth, and so she's sort of reliving that once Jake Gyllenhaal's character leaves. Mm.
And does it give you a feeling that Dano might be able to kind of spread his wings and direct a variety of things, or does it feel like maybe this might be a voice that he would be settling with?
I think... I'm hopeful for whatever he would do next, because I think the strength that he really has here is how well he takes care of his actors and his characters. You can tell that he's put so much detail into the direction and has really let these characters come to life by having such patience with his actors. And I hope that could be applicable to such a variety of stories.
That's so true. Like, if you can just get the characters right, then you can pretty much plonk them into any genre you like. And perhaps time to move genre. Let's definitely take a hard right handbrake turn into the heist of Widows. So Steve McQueen, one of the most interesting voices in contemporary British cinema, directs a vital reimagining of the 80s TV drama Widows, based on the novel by Linda LaPlante. In his first foray into genre filmmaking, McQueen's crime thriller transplants the story to modern-day Chicago and ups the ante with Viola Davis shining through in an ensemble cast of widows who follow their husband's footsteps into crime after a botched job. And there's someone in the room who may have already seen this three times, despite the fact it only came out yesterday. Kelly, I'm going to have to interrogate you here. Is Widows a good film?
It's an excellent film. just to clarify, I didn't see it three times yesterday. I saw it at a screening, and then I saw it at LFF, and then I went with a friend the other day because I was like, this is an important film to see. I really, really loved it. I love Steve McQueen. I can't say, like, you know, I've been, you know, in quotes, following his career, but I have been a huge, huge fan of his since I watched Hunger ages ago. So this film feels like a real, I think, at the outset, departure for him. It is certainly more mainstream than his previous films, like Shame and, again, Hunger. But I do think it still grapples with a lot of those themes that he's become known for. So intimacy, he's thinking about grief. The film is really fascinating and really quite subtle exploration at the same time as being a really high-powered heist movie and political thriller. It's a really subtle exploration of grief and the things that these women do to sort of fill up that space that their husbands, who were not perfect men, who were in many ways deeply, deeply bad and problematic and abusive men, but, you know, they love them. And I really appreciate how emotionally driven this film is at the same time as being really just, you know, full of action and also having a lot to say about the era that we're living in currently politically.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned about following McQueen, but not really. As soon as you mentioned that, I suddenly realized that, oh yeah, I can actually remember where I was every time that I watched one of his films
exactly.
for the first time.
Yeah.
I've never really thought of him as being a director that I follow like that. But clearly each one made an impact. And I love a heist.
Yeah.
I feel like, I was so excited to hear about this. I can't resist them. It's been a phenomenal year for heists.
Yes.
But this is really at the top end. I loved it. And what was brought in from those films that you can see here, what's classic McQueen and what's new McQueen? What is the most exciting, fresh stuff that we're seeing here in Widows for the first time?
Well, I think that, first of all, it's the first of his film to focus on women, because his other films, he does have interesting female characters, but they're not the main focus of it. Whereas here, obviously, you have Viola Davis leading this incredible cast of, you know, of mostly women. You've got Elizabeth Debicki, Cynthia Erivo, and Michelle Rodriguez, who are all fantastic. That is a clear departure from his previous films, but you've still got that same kind of human focus, and which really grapples with, as you said, Kelly, these women's emotion and their pain and the way that they are kind of damaged and conflicted, as well as being, of course, strong and empowering and everything else that they are.
And then he takes with him, you know, again, his cinematographer, Sean Bobbitt. There are a lot of moments in this film that really feel sort of evocative of shame. And in a couple of moments, even like 12 Years of Shame. But I think that's just sort of like, you know, the stylized, you know, aesthetic of it, really close-up shots of you know, profiles and hands. It's just like it's stunning to behold. And I also think it's important to say that Viola Davis looks amazing in this film, and she wears incredible clothes.
Yes.
I say that in jest, but also it is a film that is very much about the intersection of class and race, and he does this so much better than really a lot of American directors have been able to do it, to, you know, sort of draw the lines between all of these people who live in this city and who are, you know, very diverse, but it doesn't feel as if he's just sort of like plopped them in and not thought about their backgrounds at all. It's really, really skillfully done, I think.
Yeah, I think talking of skillful moments, there's one particular one that I think has appeared in every review, but I'm going to talk about it anyway, which is the car bonnet shot. This follows Jack Mulligan, which is Colin Farrell's character, who's kind of on his first rung of the political ladder, eventually dreams of being the mayor, and he does a rally in the kind of project area of the city. He's going for a rally for this dodgy scheme called the Minority Women of Work scheme, which he set up, which is borderline Alan Partridge. It's so cringy. And then the camera is just sat on his car bonnet as he moves from sticks stuck up somewhere, politician mode, trying to sound impressive to all of these people that he's really exploiting, and getting in the car. And the camera just stays on the car as it drives through the streets. And within a matter of minutes, we go from quite a dilapidated area to the tall, iron-fenced homes of the people that he's really supporting and the people that he's really helping. It's not subtle, but I think it's really impressive. And it's really elegantly done. And in Sight and Sound, Steve McQueen spoke about this moment. And what I loved about it is that he said, also being British, we can stretch a pound. We have to. Such limitations give you a certain kind of freedom. And that's exactly it. Like, in this moment, they've covered what could be a montage of travel and the conversation inside the car of a shot reverse and all of this. And instead, in one single move and saving a lot of everyone's time and money, you've actually made something more impressive. And I think I love the way that he's thinking about being a filmmaker, of not just how can I make an impact, but how can I do this on the resources that I've got to make the maximum impact.
Well, he also has that in, as you were saying, Kelly, the costumes, that some of the things that Viola Davis wears are so stunning.
Yeah.
And it's another thing of him not necessarily needing to be subtle, but just being making very simple but bold choices. The black and white in this film, all of the colours just pop so much and look incredible. And it means that when you do have the odd flash of colour, like there's one tiny moment in particular, I think it's in the trailer, when you see Daniel Kaluuya just looking on. He is waving at everyone with these haunting eyes. Ugh. And you just see a flash of bright pink bubblegum. Mm. And it's just a tiny detail. But because Steve McQueen has set up the way he uses colours this way, when you have that little pop of this alien flash of colour, God, it's amazing.
We also have to just talk briefly about how scary Daniel Kaluuya
is in this film.
Stop. He's incredible. I also want to say Brian Tyree Henry has given, he gives two incredible, understated performances in both If Beale Street Could Talk and this film. Mm-hmm. Like, he's
Absolutely.
Also very menacing in this film. He does a very bad thing with the dog. So,
yeah.
Warning dog lovers out there. But Daniel Kaluuya is phenomenal and has really, like, proven himself to be a really incredible actor. He's doing an entirely different American accent than he was doing in Get Out.
Yeah.
And he is like essentially the muscle for his brother, who's played by Brian Tyree Henry's called Jamal. They don't want to go, you know, straight, but they do want to have, I guess, more legitimate businesses as to, like, you know, essentially increase their income. But yeah, I think Dan Kaluuya does a great job with this role. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to, like, you know, go over the top with this, and he gets it just right. It's beautiful.
He's not like a henchman for a Bond villain. He is so scary in this. Like, I was checking over my notes before we came in the room on my phone, and I realized I had just written bowling alley twice.
I mean, I think it's saying something that everyone I've spoken to who's seen this film, we all relayed different moments when in the screening we were in, there was audible gasps, clapping, whooping, all for similar reasons, but just in completely different circumstances with audiences, and it just shows how much his performance just hits you in the face.
Yeah.
And talking of gaspable moments, I love Viola Davis completely overpowering a scene and controlling everyone while still holding a tiny little dog.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
There is a scene in which Viola Davis literally, they're talking about her behind her back, and she literally appears holding a, like, pure white dog. It's like, you know, he is like,
unbelievable.
It would be like a villain moment. But she's great. And I have to say, she does not get the respect that she deserves in this film. And that is what I will say about that.
Brilliant. So that is Widows, which it sounds like in this room we like a lot. And Ella, there's going to be a little bit more hashtag content available from yourself.
Oh, there is.
And because we've got a piece coming up on the blog very soon, linking these two together as well and looking at those female characters in them. Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. So it's going to be focusing on characters that we mentioned today. So on Viola Davis in Widows and Carey Mulligan in Wildlife. And just how much I love these performances and kind of reckoning with the idea that these women are unlikable, as described by audiences who have seen the film. I don't know if I would agree. I'm going to draw the line between what is a strong character, what is a likable character, who are these women, and why should we watch them?
Excellent. So keep your eyes peeled for that. If you, for some reason, don't fancy going to the cinema this weekend, you can stay in and you can watch something on Curzon Home Cinema if you like. We've recently got Custody on there, which is the film that we spoke to Denis Minichet of that opening scene from Inglourious Basterds all about. And there's also a new Best of Mike Leigh collection to coincide with the release of Peterloo. So on there, you've got Vera Drake, Life is Sweet, and Mr. Turner. And if you're interested in Peterloo, you can go back to our episode last week where we spoke to Mike all about that film. And if you've got any thoughts on Widows or Wildlife or any of the other recent releases that we've spoken about, then do email us at podcast@curzon.com. We'd love to hear your thoughts on these films. Next week, the witching hour is upon us as we try and unravel the rhythms of Luca Guadagnino's Suspiria. And that's really about it. We must say bye for this week. It's been so nice to have you both here. Thank you, Kelly, for joining us. If people want to catch up with you and find your writing, can they do that anywhere?
You can find my writing on The Skinny and for Sight and Sound, of course.
Great. And Ella, follow you on Twitter.
Yeah. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at EFEKemp, or you can read me on Culture Whisper or Sight and Sound sometimes.
Brilliant. And if it's your first time listening to the show, then please do subscribe, give us a review or a comment wherever you get your pods. That might be iTunes, Acast, wherever. We don't discriminate. Thanks so much for joining us. Bye bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.